December 27th, 1979. December 27th, 1979. Continuing at El Paso, Texas. These tape recordings of the Adventures in On History lecture series for the spring of 1980. Tonight, 10:06, we commence to adventure with Prester John. On learning that in the year, whatever it was, the same letter was delivered, that is, one letter was delivered in triplicate, to the Byzantine Emperor, to the Holy Roman Emperor, and to the Pope, a natural question would be, how? That is, how delivered? The 12th century, was it the 13th, and used to be, and perhaps by some still is, regarded as a very happy time. My sophomore English instructor, for one, said that each man felt spiritually secure in the 12th century, or was it the 13th? And as he eventually rose to be dean, one must suppose that he knew, well, something. He didn't know how to read Greek, though. Yes, but he was in the Department of English, so what difference did that make? The difference is that he didn't know that he didn't know, and insisted on reading it anyway, or anyway one line of it. From Lord Byron, not generally regarded as one of the more prominent Greek poets. Maid of Athens, there we go, Zoe Mou, Sasagapo. Which can be translated as either, my life, I love you, or Zoe, mine, I love you. Zoe, meaning life, as in zoology, being also a woman's name in Greek. Dr. Needler, however, mistaking the upsilon for a nu, invariably read it, Zoe Mon Sasagapo. As a result of which publicly displayed ignorance, he eventually, as I have said, became dean. There is a moral there, could we but see it. Anyway, back to the 12th century. Whatever else existed then or did not exist, two things did not which do today. There were no police forces, and there were no mail services. But somebody must have either ridden or trudged with it up to those three palaces. Letter for the emperor, we can imagine him saying, easily. What is somewhat more difficult to imagine is the reply. Was this, throw it over the postern gate, or the drawbridge doesn't open for another hour, or what news on the Rialto, or yeah, who's it from? To the answer from Prester John, however, it is doubtful that any but the most ignorant gate porter would have come back with, Prester who? Because even before the arrival of the letter, by whatsoever means, those in the know, in Constantinople, in Rome, and in whatever place the Holy Roman Emperor, who was actually always a German, was currently keeping his capital, had already heard of Prester John, as you were all about to. There was a story told in the late 1940s of an American scholar who, finding the book he wanted, listed in the catalog of the Vatican Library, filled out a call slip for it, only to have the slip returned with the comment, missing since 1555. If any of the three original copies of the letter from Prester John had survived the attrition of the centuries, one would suppose it to have been the one to the Pope. Say what one will, the Pope's kept a good library. But one would be wrong. The sole surviving copy is the one to the Byzantine Emperor. How come? That's one of the many mysteries about the letter. And for that matter, about Prester John himself. Who was he? Don't you wish you knew? Prester is an old form of the word priest, and evidently it survives in this sole usage alone. It is no secret that it is simply a short form of the word presbyter. And as Milton informs us in, I think, his Areopagitica, new presbyters but old priests writ large. Why new? Well, That would take us into the 17th century, and we haven't even finished with the 12th yet, so have patience. Prester John then means Priest John, or John the Priest. In my ever-so-distant youth, every drugstore, and there was almost a drugstore in every corner, and if you didn't want drugs, you could always go there for an ice cream soda, a box of candy, a tuna fish sandwich, or items of a sort which are now displayed as openly as Band-Aids, but which were then sold for the prevention of disease only, and were kept next to the opium and guarded by a dragon, which would strike you dead if you were under 18 years of age. Every drugstore had a bunch of bottles labeled Father John's Medicine next to the Lydia E. Pinkham Vegetable Compound. You might therefore refer to Prester J. as Father John, but I shouldn't if I were you. Well, you may ask, what is more natural than that a priest, be he named John or whatsoever he be named, why should he not write a letter to the Pope or to this or that emperor if he so wished? It is true that a cat may look at a queen, but it is also true that it was unlikely for a mere priest to be writing to anyone of higher station than, say, his own bishop or the lord of the manor in which he lived. If he had cause to try and catch the attention of those higher than that, they would have been the logical ones to try and do it for him, or not, as the case might be. For in those days, you see, every man knew his place, for every man had a place to know, a place on earth for one thing, and a place in paradise thereafter. All supposing he was obedient and dutiful in the keeping of the laws sacred and secular. However, this one was no ordinary priest. But suppose we look at the letter. It begins with the words, John, priest by the omnipotence of God and the power of our Lord Jesus Christ, King of kings, ruler of rulers, hopes for the well-being of his friend Emmanuel, Prince of Constantinople and governor of the Romans, and wishes that the grace of God be with him in the future. Or so in one version, likely a copy of a copy, at least. Remember that this letter had no official status. Copyists were, therefore, free not only to make mistakes, a privilege which they maintain to this day, but to make changes if they felt like it. Presumably the copies of the letter to the Holy Roman Emperor and to the Pope began more or less the same, with changes appropriate in the matter of names and titles. We might point out that, as for titles, the Byzantine emperor did not call himself Prince of Constantinople and Governor of the Romans, and that if he had, these would have been about at the bottom of the list. Probably they would have been borne by his youngest son as mere courtesy titles. Much as the Prince of Wales is also, and incidentally, Lord of the Isles and Baron Renfrew. However, Prester John might perhaps be excused for not knowing enough, at least to begin, with such basic items as, say, Emperor of Rome, of New Rome, and of the East, Caesar Augustus, Autocrator, Sebastocrator, and so on for miles and miles. Prester John might perhaps be excused for not knowing all this, because Prester John was not from Europe. He was not from Asia Minor. He was from far, far away indeed. He was from, in fact, so far, far away that no one really exactly knew how far away, or even approximately, or exactly or even approximately where he was from. So, as was common enough in those days, as it had been back in days long before that, they said he was from India. Now, we know where India is. It is, for one thing, on our nice, neat Rand McNally or National Geographical Society maps. It is an extremely large peninsula, a subcontinent, it is often called, and it protrudes into the Indian Ocean with Pakistan on its west, Burma and Bangladesh on its east, etc., etc. But in times past, people had not these nice sureties. They were, to say the least, somewhat confused, and the confusion went back to the times of the ancient Greeks. Recall that before the magnetic compass, not even north and south were known for certain, that east and west depended upon the shifting position of the sun's path as the swift seasons rolled. All that was known about certain far-off lands were these undeniable facts. If you turned up the Nile and traveled immense distances, you came at last to a land where it was very hot, and the people were very dark, and there were crocodiles in the rivers. Originally, no doubt, this description was intended only to describe and define the country we now call the Sudan in Africa. Later, it was to be extended under the name of Ethiopia. But just keep in mind that Alexander the Great did not really want to discover the sources of the Nile. He really wanted to conquer Persia. So he did not keep on heading south. Neither did he turn and head west. He turned and went east. He did indeed conquer the Persians. He traveled immense distances, and eventually he came to a land where it was very hot, and the people were very dark, and where there were crocodiles in the rivers. Obviously, Ethiopia, from the Greek Ethiops, meaning burned. However, the people there, not having the benefits of a good Greek education, or even a bad one, seemed not to know that their country was Ethiopia. They said it was India. Well, what's in a name? Ethiopia was India then? So India was Ethiopia. Heat is heat, far is far, dark people are dark people, crocodiles are crocodiles, rivers are rivers. Hadn't Homer himself sung of Ethiopians of the sunrise and of the sunset? Yes, he had. So by the time of the Middle Ages, it was generally understood that there was more than one India, and that it was one hell of a long ways away. Also, very rich. This may surprise us, thinking as we do of India as very poor. But in those days, there was still gold in India, still diamonds, and lots of spices, worth their weight in gold and diamonds. Not only did spices taste good, they were good medicine, the antibiotics of the day, and kept meat from spoiling, often. So when word began to get around Europe that there was a Christian kingdom in, of all places, India, no one scoffed, everyone listened. We today know that if there is not exactly a Christian kingdom in India, there are Christians in India. And why shouldn't there be, in view of all the missionaries who have gone there and still are going there from Europe and America? However, the facts are that there were Christians in India even before missionaries went there from Europe and America, before America was discovered by Europe under the impression that it was India. It was a belief, a tradition, and one which, having never been disproven, is still held by some today, that when the apostles Peter and Paul and Matthew and John and Barnabas and so on went north and west, preaching and converting and establishing churches, one of the apostles went east, to wit, St. Thomas, the doubting one, and kept on until he got to India, where he preached and converted and, of course, established churches. Consequently, the appearance in Western Christendom, earlier in the century, of someone called John, Patriarch of India, while it caused surprise, did not cause either astonishment or suspicion. It did, of course, cause great interest. Keep in mind that patriarch here is used neither in the sense of the patriarch Abraham, nor in that of the patriarch of Constantinople. The meaning here is that of an ecclesiastical official of about the rank of archbishop. Lisbon, for example, has a patriarch. Of course, the Pope was well aware that he had not himself appointed or authorized any patriarch in India. But if this fellow John was decent enough to come all the way to Rome, the Pope was not going to quibble. Chap wants to be called patriarch, does he? Very well. Nice chap. Touch of the tar brush, no doubt, but no harm in that. See how politely he kisses our hand. One of you chaps in the Roman Curia, catechize him and see if he knows the right doctrine. Give him some nice little presents, and make sure that he doesn't go gallivanting off to either the Eastern or Byzantine emperor, or the Holy Roman, that is to say, Western Emperor, upsetting the balance of power. Pax vobiscum, John. Next. John, Patriarch of India, presently went away, back to India, presumably, where, not knowing how immensely valuable spices were, he mixed them all up with his rice and fish and called it curry. And now, after all these years, here was a letter from him, see? John, priest, not even patriarch this time. See what it says here? Priest, modest chap, must be getting on in years. What does he say? But before we see what he said, let us talk a bit more about the question of, quote, India, unquote. What I have said about the native Christian churches in India was intended by me to refer to India, the country of that name as we know it today. But medieval people, I repeat, had a much broader notion of the name. To this day, in the Netherlands, in Holland, India may mean the islands of the Malay Archipelago, which used to be called the Netherlands or Dutch East Indies, Malaysia and Indonesia, in other words, in Holland to this day, are sometimes called India. This is a relic of the old notion. In the Middle Ages, people did not carry maps in their heads or pockets. Maps were very rare. They were also very wrong, for that matter. If we reprehend them for thinking of Tartary, Tibet, Turkestan, and most of Central Asia as being also India, if we think it somewhat silly to have thought of Ethiopia as India, and of Burma and Thailand and adjacent countries as India, please remember that until very recently, Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam were by us lumped together under the name Indochina. Medieval Europeans, those of them who thought about such things, did indeed make anyway some attempt to keep the geography of the East straightened out. They, in their maps, referred to India before the Ganges and India beyond the Ganges, and of First India, Second India, and Third India, for example. And if calling a part of Africa India seems silly to us, what about our use of the name the West Indies for over 400 years after our forebears realized that these islands were no part of India at all? As late as the mutiny on the Bounty, English-speaking people were calling Polynesians Indians. And if some of our American Aborigines now appropriate to themselves, to the exclusion of the rest of us, the term Native Americans, it may be well realized that they are, after all, really not Indians, not even really American Indians. To sum up, then, in medieval Europe, the term India and the Indies in the Middle Ages meant foreign parts not in Europe, nor in North Africa, nor in Asia Minor, the Levant, nor any land of the Saracens, more or less. It might be added that in Europe quite a lot was known about Asia Minor and the Levant because the Crusades were still going on and Christian kingdoms existed in what is now Turkey, Syria, Lebanon, and Israel. But the fact that comparatively little was known about India did not mean that comparatively little was cared. Quite a bit, as I hope I have explained, was cared. So, there was John, Patriarch of India, who appeared and disappeared rather early in the 12th century. He certainly had not borne the title of Patriarch in his native land. No doubt he had taken advantages of the distance from the facts to build himself up, in much the same fashion as Queen Victoria's Indian Munshi Abdullah told the Queen that his father was the head of the Indian Medical Service, when in fact the old man was the dispensing pharmacist at the Agra jail. This, John, had no direct physical effect either on Europe or on India, but his mere presence had helped prepare the scene. It was now known that there were Christians in India, and it was believed that some of them were of high rank. What else had happened? This. Sometime after the departure of this Eastern ecclesiastical gentleman, and before the arrival of the letter, a European bishop visiting in Syria was told by a local bishop that there was a very interesting ruler in Asia, Somewhere beyond Persia and Armenia, in the uttermost east, here I quote DeCamp. What made him so interesting? Well, for one thing, he was a Christian. For another, he called himself Rex et Sacerdos, priest and king. Also, he had defeated the kings of Persia and Media, both Muslims. Then he had tried to go west and join up with the crusading kingdoms there, but he had no boats to cross the Tigris and Euphrates. So, after waiting hopefully for those rivers to freeze, in order that he and his armies might go over on the ice, which the rivers declined to do, back he had gone. Where? Wherever. The European bishop had asked what kind of Christians the victorious eastern ruler and his followers were. The Syrian bishop replied, doubtless with a deprecating tone of voice, that they were Nestorians. It had been hundreds of years since the doctrine of Nestorius had been declared heretical, that the Virgin Mary could not be called Mother of God, as she was merely the mother of the body in which God dwelt. So this was not the best of news, good news. Still, it was better news than bad. Theologians had known that Asia was full of Nestorians, what a shame, with their absurd insistence that St. Peter had established a church in Asia before going on to Europe. Which church was, in fact, the Church of the East, or Nestorian Church? A shame, but still, Christians were Christians, and even heretics might be persuaded. The main and common enemy was, after all, Islam, which had been trying for hundreds of years to conquer the world, and had often seemed close to success. Well, there was afar off then a Christian king, who was also a priest. It was certainly very odd. But that was, of course, no reason why it should not be true. And if his kingdom lay beyond Persia, why then, obviously, it lay in India. As Slesarov puts it, the night cloud of legends around India was slowly lifting, but the lines between reality and myth were still indistinct. And so, just as today, to many people, India, despite its distance and dangers, is the land where spiritual enlightenment may yet be found. So in the 1100s, it began to seem that it was in India, despite its dangers and distances, that the physical and political salvation of Christendom might yet be found. For the moment, the fighting forces of al-Islam were being contained by the Byzantine Emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor, and such warrior kings as those of France and England. But one never knew if the situation might not change, in which case, suppose there really was a possible ally, an enemy of Islam, on the Eastern Front. Would it not help? How could it hurt? The Syrian bishop, Hugh, who was actually from France, had added a few details to interest and convince the indifferent. The great priest king, said this bishop, was from a very ancient Christian lineage, to wit, the Magian kings who had brought gifts to Bethlehem. This explains what he was doing way back there beyond Persia. Also, he was very, very rich. Ears pricked up at this all over Europe and Byzantium and the Christian Levant. He was? Oh. This, in brief, or perhaps not in so damn much brief, was the background for those three letters for the Pope and the two emperors. I should like, perhaps, to be able to read you the original in its entirety, but for one thing, it was in Latin, and it was rather long. It has been translated into English, but the translation has not been published, and even the abridged form, which has been, is too long. So let us listen to just a few parts of the latter, shall we? Okay. John, priest by the grace of God, most powerful king over all Christian kings, greetings to the Emperor of Rome, etc. We worship and believe in Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, three persons in one deity. Let it be known to you that we have the highest crown on earth, as well as gold, silver, precious stones, and strong fortresses. We have under our sway 42 kings who are almighty and good Christians. Know also that we have promised and sworn in our good faith to conquer the sepulchre of our Lord and the whole promised land. Our land is divided into four parts, for there are so many Indias. In Greater India lies the body of the Apostle St. Thomas, and this India is toward the east, for it is near the deserted Babylon. There are in our countries elephants and other animals called dromedaries, the strangest lions of red, green, black, and blue, and wild asses with two little horns who gallop faster than any other animal. Know that we have birds called griffins who can easily carry an ox or a horse into their nest to feed their young, and men who feed only on human flesh, and they do it for the redemption of their sins. This cursed nation is called Gog and Magog. We have bowmen who from the waist up are men, but whose lower part is that of a horse. Also unicorns, a bird called Phoenix, and many precious stones such as emeralds, sapphires, rubies, wild pepper. One of our kings collects from the great king of Israel every year 200 horses loaded with precious stones, gold, and silver. In front of us there march 40,000 priests and 40,000 knights, followed by 200,000 men on foot, and wagons with provisions, elephants, and camels which carry arms and ammunition. We are a priest, and we are a king. The walls of our palace are of crystal. The ceiling above is of precious stones and is adorned with stars, and its floor is also of crystal. There need be no windows in this palace, and inside it has 24 columns of gold and precious stones. All the scribes on earth could not report or describe the riches of our palace and chapel. Everything we have written to you is as true as there is God. If you desire from us something that we can fulfill, do not hesitate to ask, for we shall do it gladly. We pray to our Lord to keep you in the grace of the Holy Spirit. Amen. Let's take another pause here and use it to have a peek at the three people to whom this curious communication was addressed. And as it came out of the East, likely the first copy to reach its destination was the one addressed to the Byzantine Emperor, who was at that time Manuel Comnenus. His father, emperor before him, was named, by the way, John. The Byzantine Empire, a name, by the way, which it never used regarding itself to the end as the Roman Empire, though nowhere as large as it had been during the time of, say, Constantine or even Justinian, was still far larger than it was to be at the time of its destruction by the Turks. Manuel, to be sure, fought the Turks, but even more, he fought his fellow Christians, and they, him. He fought Sicily, then a Norman kingdom. He fought the Venetians, the Serbs, and the Hungarians. He captured Corfu, part of southern Italy, and Dalmatia, and he defeated the Christian minor monarch, Count Raymond of Antioch in Syria. The Encyclopedia Britannica says, in spite of his military prowess, Manuel achieved but in a slight degree his object of restoring the East Roman Empire. His victories were counterbalanced by numerous defeats. The expense of keeping up his mercenary establishment put a severe strain upon the financial resources of the state. The subsequent rapid collapse of the Byzantine Empire was largely due to his brilliant but unproductive reign. The Holy Roman Empire, so-called, was then ruled by Frederick I, called Barbarossa, because of his red beard. This is not Barbarossa, the Barbary pirate, who lived long later. This realm, of which we are perhaps bored to hear again that Voltaire said it was neither holy, nor Roman, nor an empire, its boundaries and composition, were about as firm as mud, and Frederick spent most of his reign trying to make them anyway somewhat firmer. This involved him in wars in Germany, Italy, Poland, Hungary, Bohemia, and again Italy. In the course of one of his Italian campaigns, he captured and sacked Rome. Despite this minor difference... Well, I think it's December 28th, and I think that this will be Side 2 of Adventures in On History, Prester John. Despite this minor difference of opinion with the Pope, Frederick was a staunch child of the Church, joined the Third Crusade, and was drowned whilst en route to smite the Saracens, or so some said. Others, on the other hand, said he wasn't dead at all, just sleeping in a cave somewhere in the German mountains, waiting to be called. One historian says that Frederick's power rested upon his earnest and commanding personality and the care with which he exacted feudal dues from his dependents, which leaves the Pope. This was Alexander III, called one of the outstanding popes in history and first of the great lawyer popes. Although occupied in troubles ranging from the murder of Thomas à Becket to no less than three antipopes, he managed to stay afloat and is considered to have had a successful reign. His merits and moral stature were recognized even by his adversaries, among whom usually was the Holy Roman Emperor, Frederick Barbarossa himself. But they kissed and made up. Trying to state briefly something, anything which all three had in common, I seize hastily upon this one. None of them was able to stay in one place permanently during his reign. Unsettled conditions did not permit. Hence, it is entirely possible that not one of the three actually received the letter from Prester John at the time it was delivered. There is no record or even tradition that either the Eastern or the Western emperors even answered it. Perhaps neither one was able to think up a claim upon Prester John's land. However, we have a copy of the reply of the Pope. Yes, he did reply. It only took him about 12 years, some say 17. It is a very interesting, if very cautious, reply. Perhaps the most interesting thing is that it seems to have been addressed to the wrong Prester John. How many were there? Since there was an anti-pope, was there also, so to speak, an anti-Prester John? A Prester anti-John? No. We will get to this by and by. One does wonder, if either emperor had replied, what would the reply have been like? What would any letter from either? I do not have their correspondence and can but guess. In the case of the Byzantine, half of it would be taken up with titles, for Manuel not only retained every title of every predecessor, but he invented some new ones as well. And half of the other half would have been taken up with the theology which has been called Byzantine, not alone referring to origin, but to complexity. As for the letters of Frederick, I imagine them to have been commonly succinct. Send 5,000 ducats or I'll tear out your toenails, something like that. And of course, each imperial ruler would have written at length about the prospect of marriage as a means of alliance, not only matrimonial, but political. As a matter of fact, both Frederick and Manuel did wind up as some sort of in-law to each other. I forget just how. It was probably of Byzantine complexity. In the end, several centuries later, Byzantium fell and ended with an immense and tragic bang. The imperial house of Comnenus in Trebizond and the imperial house of Palaeologus in Constantinople. The Holy Roman Imperium lasted for centuries more, having finally transformed marriage into a form of acquisition never before known. Motto: let others wage warfare. Thou, O happy Habsburgs, marry. The happy Habsburgs ending not with a bang, but a whimper, as they trotted out the back gate of the palace garden one night in 1918. I saw the tomb of the last Austrian emperor on the island of Madeira. It was in an appropriate state of disrepair. There is certainly an evil genius of simplicity in those lines. But back to the 12th century and the letter from Prester John. If two of the three to whom the letter was addressed failed to answer it, and if the third one who did took half a generation to do so, it could hardly have been very important, right? Wrong. Wrong for the right reasons, and right for the wrong reasons. It was very important, though it has to be said, less for fact than for fancy. It was as important for what it did not contain, also, as for what it did. So as we cannot, alas, hear the original words of this letter, Let us hear some original words from something which paved the way for it. I've said that Bishop Hugh of Syria has spoken with someone I've referred to only as a German bishop. This was, in fact, Bishop Otto of Freising, described by Slesarev as one of the greatest historians of the Middle Ages, and his relation, Slesarev, appears in Book 7 of his Chronicle. The translation is by Charles Miero. Bishop Hugh of Jabalah in Syria began by complaining that the Patriarch of Antioch and the mother-in-law of Count Raymond did not share properly the spoils taken from the Saracens. He complained, in fact, to the Pope, but must have shrugged a patient shrug. Emperors and patriarchs the Pope could perhaps handle, but who could handle mothers-in-law? Otto then dipped his quill in the inkwell and went on to write. Bishop Hugh related also that not many years before, a certain John, a king and priest, who dwells beyond Persia and Armenia in the uttermost east, and with all his people, is a Christian but a Nestorian, made war on the brother kings of Persians and Medes, and stormed Ecbatana, the seat of their kingdom. When the aforesaid kings met him with an army, a battle ensued which lasted for 3 days, since both parties were willing to die rather than turn in flight. Prester John, for so they are accustomed to call him, putting the Persians to flight with dreadful carnage, finally emerged victorious. He said that after this victory, the aforesaid John moved his army to the aid of the church in Jerusalem, but that when he had reached the river Tigris, he was unable to transport his army across that river by any device, the continued mild weather preventing the river from freezing. Because of the unfamiliar climate, he was forced to return home. It is said that he is a lineal descendant of the Magi, of whom mention is made in the Gospel, and that, ruling over the same peoples whom they governed, he enjoys such great glory and wealth that he uses no scepter save one of emerald. Inflamed by the example of his fathers who came to adore Christ in his manger, he had planned to go to Jerusalem, but by reasons aforesaid, he was prevented, so men say, but enough of this. If the cautious note indicated by "so men say" belongs properly to Bishop Otto or to Bishop Hugh or both, quien sabe. But the element of almost impatience indicated by the "but enough of this" is certainly purely Bishop Otto's. He had, after all, other things to write down beyond whatever prattle came from the uttermost east. Otto was not just a plain bishop, he was the grandson of the Holy Roman Emperor Henry IV, and his mother, Otto's, by her first marriage, was the grandmother of the then Emperor Frederick. So Otto was, shall we say, well connected, and in his "but enough of this" lies perhaps a clue to the reason why Frederick did nothing in the matter of the letter of Prester John when it subsequently came. Had Bishop Otto been more interested, perhaps the emperor would have been more interested. It has been said of the biblical commentator Lyra that, had Lyra never fiddled, Luther had not danced. Otto, in the matter of Prester John, never fiddled. Perhaps he didn't care for the tune. Well, what truth, if any, may lie in this report at third or 23rd hand? The bishops met in the year 1145. Had there been any big battles in the few years preceding then? Had there in particular been one very big battle? There sure had. Somewhere near the then great city of Samarkand, whither the poet James Elroy Flecker's Hassan was to take the Golden Road, in the year 1141, there had been an immense battle. The news had taken only 4 years to reach Europe, which was not bad for those days, particularly considering the distance, for Samarkand is nearer to China than to Rome. It is hardly a surprise to learn that some of the details have been garbled in transition. In fact, all of the details have been garbled in transition. For one thing, there were no brother kings of Persians and Medes involved. The vanquished was Sultan Sanjar, ruler of the Seljuk Turks, of the same race, perhaps of a different branch, as was Saladin, the famed king of the Saracens during the Third Crusade, which also incidentally involved Richard the Lionhearted. If Sultan Sanjar was the vanquished, who then was the victor? We are told that this was someone of whom we would not ordinarily have heard, one Yedi Tashir, the founder of the Karahitai Empire in Central Asia. Oh. Assuming that Bishop Hugh's account was correct, then Yedi Tashir must have been Prester John. Except that, for one thing, we have already seen that Bishop Hugh's account was not, in all detail so far, correct. What does Karahitai mean? Well, it means Black Cathay. In fact, the name Hittai is the origin of the name Cathay, which we know, if we know it at all, chiefly in connection with Marco Polo, who came later. To us, Cathay is China. But that is only because at the time of Marco's visit, China was under the rule of a non-Chinese dynasty, or dynasty. Kublai Khan, Polo's magnanimous host, was the grandson of Genghis Khan, the Mongolian conqueror. The name Yedi Tashir is clearly an attempt on the part of the Chinese to assimilate into the Chinese tongue what to them must have been some very barbarous syllables. I regret that I cannot tell you what his name really was in the idiom of Karahitai, for my knowledge of the idiom of Karahitai is limited, I am afraid, to the words Karahitai. I can, however, tell you this much. In the Turkic and Tatar languages, Kara means black. Either the victorious nation was related by blood or by language, not the same thing at all, to the Turks and Tatars, or else the name of their nation, like the name of their ruler, is transmitted and perhaps transmuted to us via the medium of yet another alien idiom, an enigma wrapped in a riddle, hidden in a mystery, which, come to think of it, is as good a summing up of the whole matter of Prester John as we are likely to find, only maybe not. Okay, if the victorious chieftain was, as Bishop Hugh said, none other than P.J., then he must have been also a Nestorian. That is, leaving aside the maybe over-emotional judgment of the Council of Nicaea or whichever, that is, a Christian. But Slesarov says that there is not a single historical source to confirm it. And he adds, on the contrary, the Chinese sources leave no doubt that he was a Buddhist. Go now. However, this is not necessarily the last word. The Chinese sources have also been known to be wrong. Furthermore, he might have been originally or transiently a Buddhist and have been at one time converted to Christianity in its Nestorian form. And if so, that is, if he had been converted, it is not at all improbable he would have been given the baptismal name of John. This was a very common practice in the past, particularly in the East, for, after all, Saint John was an evangelist. However, the fact, or rather the non-fact, remains. There is no proof. There isn't really even any evidence. There is only a possibility. Since I do not have the translation of the full text of the original letter of Prester John, in fact, I do not even have the full text untranslated. In fact, it is merely one of the questions concerning this immensely curious document, which language its text was originally composed in. Therefore, I shall read next an abstract of the original, so-called, as contained in the Britannica, and we shall take it from there. The letter dealt at length with the wonders of his empire. It was his desire to visit the Holy Sepulchre with a great host and to subdue the enemies of the cross. 72 kings reigning over his many kingdoms were his tributaries. His empire extended over the three Indies, including that farther India, Where lay the body of St. Thomas? To the sun rising, and back again down the slope, to the ruins of Babylon and the Tower of Babel. All the wild beasts and monstrous creatures commemorated in current legend were to be found in his dominions, as well as all the wild and eccentric races of men of whom strange stories were told. The language here is, of course, that of the Britannica's unnamed author, and not that of the letter. Including those unclean nations whom Alexander the Great walled up among the mountains of the north, and who were to come forth at the latter day. And so were the Amazons and the Brahmins. His dominions contained the monstrous ants that dug gold, and the fish that gave the purple. We have met those ants and their gold before, I hope you will recall, back upon the borders of Hyperborea. The fish that gave the purple refers to the shellfish murex, from which the famous Tyrian dye was made. His dominions produced all manner of precious stones and all the famous aromatics. Within them was found the fountain of youth, the pebbles which give light, restore sight, and render the possessor invisible. The sea of sand was there, stored with fish of wondrous savor, and the river of stones was there also, besides a subterranean stream whose sands were full of gems. His territory produced the worm called salamander, which lived in fire and which wrought itself an incombustible envelope from which were manufactured robes for the presbyter, which were washed in flaming fire. In war, 13 great crosses made of gold were carried in wagons before Prester John as his standards, and each was followed by 10,000 knights and 100,000 footmen, that is, infantry. There were no poor in his dominions, no thief or robber, no lies and no vices. His palace was built after the plan of that which St. Thomas erected for the Indian king Gandophorus. Before it was a marvelous mirror erected on a many-storied pedestal. In this speculum he could discern everything that went on throughout his dominions and detect conspiracies. Prester John was served by 7 kings at a time, by 60 dukes and 365 counts. 12 archbishops sat on his right hand and 20 bishops on his left, besides the Patriarch of St. Thomas's and the arch-protopope of Susa, where the royal residence was. Should it be asked why, with all his power and splendor, he calls himself merely presbyter? This is because of his humility, and because it is not fitting for one whose chamberlain was a bishop and king, and whose chief cook was an abbot and king, to be called by such titles as these, and so on. To us, reading this as an age which has skepticism as its very basis and believes in invisibility pebbles, the fountain of youth, and fireproof worms, and so on, no more than in fairy tales, all this is gaudy nonsense. We ask, how could anyone have believed it? But 800 years ago, the view was different. The gaudy bits were taken as just so many realistic details, and the more familiar they might be from other reports, the more they disposed towards acceptance and belief. Frederick the Western Emperor might not have accepted, and Manuel the Eastern Emperor might not have believed. Others did. Why? If I had to give a modern parallel, I would be driven to invent one. Suppose we were told that on the other side of Mars lived a race of human beings who were vigorously anti-communist and who possessed the means of creating energy easily and cheaply by a secret formula which they were eager to put at our disposal. Would not many believe it? Would not millions want to believe it? Suppose, in addition, we were informed that these men from Mars were descended from the inhabitants of Atlantis and had been scouting the Earth in flying saucers. Multitudes would believe it. Now, the accounts of all the wonders of the kingdom or empire of Prester John can be traced to tales current long before the letter. to the medieval legends of the supposed discoveries of Alexander the Great, for example. Others, such as the fireproof worm which secreted asbestos like silk, and such as the unicorn, have been circulating for centuries. Since none of these really existed, it is easy to draw the not illogical conclusion that Prester John did not really exist either. Nor did he. Anyway, not as described in the letter. However, the Pope, as we have said, did not rush up to his secretary with the words, "Take a letter to Prester John, dear Jack." But evidently, eventually, the Pope, old Alexander III, did decide to send a reply. Two manuscript copies survive, one in Cambridge and one in Paris. Unlike the letter itself, these are dated September 22nd, 1177, and begin, "Carissimo in Christo Filio Johanni, illustro in magnifico indorum regi, regi." This, with the valor of ignorance, I translate as, "Most beloved in Christ, son John, illustrious and magnificent king of India." This data, by the way, is from the EB again, and so, from the EB, I read on again. The Pope recites how he had heard of the monarch's Christian profession, diligence in good works and piety by various narrators and common report, but also more particularly from his physician and confidant, Philip, who had received information from honorable persons of the monarch's kingdom. What has been happening? Has the Pope in the intervening years perhaps concluded that King Gandaforos of India was, as has been said, none other than Gaspar, who along with Balthazar and Melchior constituted Los Reyes Magos, the Magian kings? Did someone tell the Pope concerning the emerald scepter of Prester John that in the sixth voyage of our other old friend Sindbad the Sailor, there is a report of the King of Ceylon right next to our own India, who had carried before him a great mace of gold at the top of which was an emerald a span in length and of the thickness of a thumb? Perhaps. Somebody seems to have told the Pope something. Who was Dr. Philip, the Pope's physician and confidant? I have no idea. Neither has anyone else. Well, what else did Dr. Philip tell the Pope? Perhaps of some evening when, tired of all those quarrelsome bishops, margraves, anti-popes, greedy old mothers-in-law of equally greedy counts, perhaps on such an evening the Pope, having taken off his robes and his tiara and put his tired old feet in a basin of hot water, and maybe after having been given something nice for his stomach, perhaps Dr. Philip looked up and said, "Ah, and by the way, Holy Father, guess what I was told today by some honorable persons from the kingdom of Prester John?" What would have been the papal reply other than, "Tell me, what?" And Dr. Philip, glad to be the bearer of reasonably good news, proceeded to tell him as follows. Prester John, it seemed, evidently not in the least miffed at having had no reply all these long years to his nice letter, was very desirous to prove his piety by establishing a church in Rome and an altar at Jerusalem. And just in case the Pope had misgivings as to was he, Prester John, really a good Christian, that is, of course, a good Catholic, so let the Pope send him some good Catholic instruction. Moved perhaps by some sudden impulse, moved perhaps by considerations to us unknown, the Pope, according to this manuscript, decided to send Philip to impart the instruction. Was it to be entirely a religious instruction? Did the Pope intend to send his own physician and confidant over miles and miles of golden sand and frightful deserts full of unicorns, griffins, salamanders, and multicolored lions and dromedaries, solely for Philip to catechize a dusky king at the end of the world? Who made the world? God made the world. Or were there perhaps other instructions? The Pope was at that time a secular as well as a religious ruler. Perhaps. It might be so. I do not know. I know, though, that the papal reply advises that Prester John send back sealed replies by trustworthy persons. And then, the Holy Father perhaps having sent for the copy of the letter from Prester John to refresh his memory, then the Pope concludes, "The less thou vauntest of thy wealth and power, the more readily shall we regard thy wishes. Teach him." Off goes Philip, never to be heard from again, or at any rate, not in any further manuscript of which we know or have ever heard. However, where did Philip go? Observe that the Pope doesn't complain that the address is vague or that it will be the devil's own task getting there. The Pope seems entirely satisfied that Phil can get there from here. It is, of course, possible that Dr. Philippus was like the U.S. Army Lieutenant Rowan, who, being told, "Take this message to Garcia," and knowing only that Garcia was a general somewhere in Cuba and in rebellion against the Spanish crown, said merely, "Yes, sir," and took off. Alas, by the time he had waded through half the swamps in Cuba to find Garcia and give him the message, Garcia said he didn't want it. Another story. I saw Rowan's picture in the papers about 1935. The army had finally decided to give him a medal. Rowan, who was in a wheelchair, looked very much as though he would much rather have had a pint of rye. Garcia, by the way, had literally a hole in his head. He kept it plugged with cotton. No, but on the whole, the tone of the papal communication is that the Pope was not in any doubt about Prester John's address. And so perhaps we shouldn't be either. What clue do we have, or do we have any, as to just who or whom the Pope thought he was sending the letter to? The clue seems to lie in the request for an altar at Jerusalem. And sometime later, we do not exactly know how much time later, an altar was being maintained at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem by a Christian king and emperor who did not live in Europe, nor for that matter in Asia Minor either. This was none other than the Negus of Abyssinia, later renamed Ethiopia, the King of Kings, the conquering lion of the tribe of Judah, whose ultimate successor, last to hold that far-off throne, died this decade, Haile Selassie. But this was in Africa? Very well, then, it was in Africa. Have I not told you that, according to medieval geography, that part of Africa was considered to be a part of India? Prester John was a Christian king somewhere in India, well, in some one of the three or four places called India, or the Indies. One of the three or four places was Abyssinia, Ethiopia. And in Ethiopia lived a Christian king. What more did one need? Here you are, Dr. Philip. Accept our benediction. Have a nice trip. Let us know when you get back. Clearly a case of mistaken identity. Here we have left Prester John having defeated the Saracens in Asia, and the Pope sends off a letter and hints of help to Africa. Is that all there is to it? Not on your tintype, kiddo. Prester John of India in Asia remains for further discussion. Let us wrap up Prester John of India in Africa. The Portuguese were very interested in Africa, and remained so until the last decade, by which time no doubt they wished they'd never heard of the place. Eventually, they made contact with the Emperor of Abyssinia, Ethiopia. They called him Prester John. The Emperor was a bit miffed. Said his name was Jacob. The Portuguese shrugged.